hold on to your butts. It's time for a new episode of Destroy All Culture, a sonic death ray from Dimension X that sounds exactly like a weekly podcast hosted by Adam P. Nave and Aiden Morgan. Exposure to Destroy All Culture is 100% fatal, so we put it on the internet. Now listen and die. Lethal effects may take up to 75 years. And it's episode 203 of Destroy All Culture. I'm Adam P. Nave, and with me as always is Aiden Morgan.
Hello.
I feel we have to do a little bit of cleanup first. People might notice that there is no episode 201. We went straight from 200 to 202. We actually recorded 201, but I had major issues on my end and lost the file. Yeah. So there's no 201. Also, as of last episode, we have new end music. Ta-da!
Ta-da! So, just more incentive to listen all the way through.
Yep. Come for the useless chatter, stay for the end music. I don't know.
It's great. You will love it. I promise, listeners and Franks, you will love it.
So, I actually kind of want to start. We were just talking about, you know, things that we were going to talk about today. And the thing you mentioned, Matt, last is kind of where I'd like to start.
Absolutely. So we're talking about Amanda's? Is that what you want me to talk about?
Yes.
Yeah. I was going down a Twitter rabbit hole, related to Golden Girls, I think, because Golden Girls has been playing in this household for the last couple of weeks.
It holds up.
It really does. Betty White's monologues are just screamingly funny. And you know, the whole thing works way better than I remembered it working. So anyway, I stumbled into knowledge of a show that I had no idea existed called Amanda's, which is starring Bea Arthur, and it's a remake, an American remake of Fawlty Towers.
Right.
And I thought to myself, it's all available on YouTube, like they're all 13 episodes. And I thought to myself, I'm going to watch the entire first episode at least, and I'll have much to report back to for Adam on our show. But I probably only made it through the first scene. It was not great. But there actually was one quite funny bit. The butler or the valet is the version of Manuel from the first one, right. And she communicates to him in terms of like cards, because he doesn't understand any English, and he keeps on saying "que," and she excuses him by saying, "You'll have to excuse him. He's from Toronto," and that just made me laugh way too much. I don't know. Even though he's a terrible, like, sort of Latino stereotype. But anyway.
So what amuses me about it...
Yes.
Was because I'd heard about Amanda's. I'd never seen any of it. But it was Bea Arthur's return to TV after Maud.
Right. Right? Yes.
So she does Maud. Ends in, like, 78, 79, one of those.
Mm-hmm.
Gets Amanda's, which, as you say, is that Fawlty Towers kind of remake thing. In 83. It does a couple episodes, it gets canceled really early, right?
Right.
Okay. A couple years later, she does Golden Girls, it's a huge hit. Golden Girls ends, and Golden Girls gets a spinoff.
Ah.
Which actually ended up lasting like 7 seasons.
Believe it or not. My God, really?
No one remembers it. I believe you can actually find all of it on YouTube as well. There's like 170 episodes, I think. And it had like a backdoor pilot in Golden Girls because they intend to do it. The joke is, for me at least, the Empty Nest, if you don't know what it is,
I'm sorry,
not Empty Nest. I'm thinking about the other one. Well, there's Empty Nest, which has a backdoor spinoff, but there's another one. I'm sorry. It didn't last 7 seasons. Empty Nest did. It was some neighbors of the Golden Girls.
Yeah, I've seen a couple.
The thing I was thinking of, sorry, which only lasted one season, which is what I remembered and was confused for a second, was Golden Palace.
I have no knowledge of
which
this.
Is all on YouTube. Okay, so Golden Palace is after the end of Golden Girls, where Bea Arthur's character gets married and goes off, right?
Mm-hmm.
The other three decide to buy a hotel in Miami.
Okay,
it's like 24 episodes of them running this hotel, and that's it. Like, it's not great, obviously. It lasted one season. But I've just always loved the idea, and I don't believe I went down the wrong pathway with the show, just because I looked it up because I couldn't remember the name of the show really well. That Bea Arthur, you know, was doing basically the hotel show. It got canceled, does Golden Girls, and is like, I'm done. And they're like, what should we do after this? Well, let's do a hotel show. Last one season gets canceled. But no, wow. Bea Arthur. It's just, I don't know, there's symmetry. It's poetry.
There's symmetry. Yeah, I might actually go dive back into Amanda's at some point, at least just watch the...
You should also watch Golden Palace. It's kind of fascinating. It has Don Cheadle.
Okay.
And Cheech.
Okay. Man, 80s TV.
And there is a really interesting episode on racism.
Oh.
Because any show that has Don Cheadle and, you know, Blanche, you're going to end up with an interesting show on racism, eventually.
Yeah.
And they do it really well.
Hmm.
So, something to look forward to.
I will look forward to it.
All, like, 20-odd episodes are on YouTube
I'll hunt down some Golden Palace. But I have a weird bit of trivia around Golden Girls and Fawlty Towers remakes. There actually have been three attempted American remakes of Fawlty Towers.
Yes. I remember the John Larroquette one.
The John Larroquette one was the third one. What was it called? I think it was called Payne. Yeah, Payne.
What's the other one?
Well, apparently it only the pilot was filmed, and it was called Snavely or Chateau Snavely, and it starred Harvey Korman and Betty White. Is for shot for a pilot in 1978. Anyway, he didn't. Apparently, John Cleese did not like it as well.
Let's be honest. Fawlty Towers is one of those shows that I think only works in its time and in England.
Well, that's the thing.
We can find it funny, and not having been adults in that time in England, you can still find it funny. But I think there's something inherent about the writing. Also, that was the other thing. They didn't have, you know, the secret weapon of Fawlty Towers.
John Cleese's legs kicking around?
No.
No, what's that?
Connie Booth.
Of course.
Without Connie Booth on the writing staff, Fawlty Towers doesn't work.
Fair enough.
Like, she doesn't get the credit she deserves half the fucking time, I swear to God. But, like, she was that show.
Hmm. Well, fair enough.
But anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me. Like, there's going to be another one eventually.
Oh, eventually. I think Oh, that's weird. I didn't realize Connie Booth was born in America.
Yep.
Sorry, I just zipped over to her, to her Wikipedia entry. At any rate, yeah. There was one other thing that I was going to say. One of the reasons that I couldn't really watch beyond the first scene is that Basil Fawlty, or John Cleese's Basil Fawlty, and Bea Arthur's character Amanda. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're just. Their personas are so different. Like, the Amanda starts with a pompous judge and his wife checking into the hotel, and it's sort of a classic sort of setup in the English version, in which Basil Fawlty is at once sort of this terrible misanthropist, but also this like bowing and scraping sycophant for upper class people, and so. And so he sort of So the full weight of like British class consciousness is always brought to bear in Fawlty Towers.
Okay.
But in the American version, she's just really sort of like grumpy, and she wants their money, obviously, but she's also wants them to like go piss off. So it's a very different dynamic, and a lot of what makes Fawlty Towers work in specific British ways does not work in an American context, and it's immediately like noticeable. Anyway,
interesting.
So,
yeah.
So that was my thing, but yeah, I was just so fascinated to find this because it's one of these little things where I'm like, how did I not know?
Right.
You know, this existed.
So. Yeah. No. And I mean, I know that like Cleese especially has done little appearances and kind of hinted at you know, like, oh, well, if we do the Basil Fawlty thing for like 10 minutes type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, someone over. And the BBC will go, let's remake this, but they're probably going to have to wait till Cleese dies.
Probably.
I don't think he'll let it happen until then in England.
Yeah.
And it should just never be done. Because, again, like I can't imagine it working anymore.
Yeah. And I propose that the actual successful remake of Fawlty Towers was Newhart. Even though it was not an actual remake.
It was the best hotel show, right?
It, precisely.
Yeah. No, I'm with you there. Yeah, just leave Fawlty Towers alone. Let it stand as its own weirdness.
I know, exactly.
I always loved it. I think Fawlty Towers was the first show, because I remember I saw some episodes of Fawlty Towers in America, you know, when I was a kid, before I was, you know, before Cheers, really. So that was the first time I'd ever seen a bar, was that bar in the hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like, wow, these are depressing looking places. I just distinctly remember that because I love hanging out in bars, whether or not I'm drinking. I love them. But like my first memory of seeing a bar was the bar in that show, and it was such a terrible, terrible place.
Oh, God,
I have,
yes.
Of course, been in hotels with bars that look exactly like it since recently, and that's the scary thing. Is it looks exactly like that one did in the 70s.
Oh, Jesus!
So, and was about as depressing.
Yeah, I have a fondness for hotel bars myself, like. Straight from the terrible decor to the like ridiculously overpriced drinks, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I like all bars, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway, past that, there was a Supernatural this week, and I don't know how
there
caught
was.
Up you are.
Yeah, no, I think I'm all caught up. I've seen episodes 15, the one with Amara, and 16, the flashback episode.
So yeah, no, you saw the Amara thing. You see what I meant last time we talked about. That Amara Dean scene.
Yeah, that was really that was some classic Supernatural goodness.
Yeah, I love it when they just let Dean get angry at like cosmic forces. I mean, it's been a staple since like season 4, the first time we see Angels, when he's just like, Angels are dicks. It's just, it's always been like, Sam has this patience of like, maybe we should, you know, honor and respect them. They're cosmic forces. And Dean's like, fuck them. And I appreciate that worldview.
Yes, I completely agree.
But yeah, no, the flashback episode. What did you think? Because it,
it was not Supernatural at its best. I'm gonna put it that way.
Yeah, I appreciate that they had one last flashback episode, even if they had to use new kids.
Yeah, they have new kids, and I thought the Sam and Dean, the people they were acting as Sam and Dean were not. Not the greatest child
actors.
There was
one moment where the kid who plays Dean is walking down the hallway and he sees the vending machine first. He just goes, "Nice," and it was just a very, very perfect Dean moment.
Yeah, that was pure Dean.
Right, but past that, it was like, here are two people who are like, just shut up, pretend you're these guys. And again, I mean, it's their first time doing it. You know, I think we accept the other kids because we haven't watched the first episode or two. And when we did, the characters weren't as defined.
Yeah, it's true.
So, like, they got to grow into it over a number of appearances, along with the characters growing into themselves.
Yeah, and it wasn't a retcon, but it felt, it had the same sort of energy as a retcon.
Yeah.
I thought sort of the adult actress who plays, who plays the Caitlin, as you know, I thought she was not given the greatest of like dialogue to work with. It just it felt a little off. But there are some bits. You know, I'm glad they pulled out Baba Yaga. I could have sworn they
which
did
I thought
Baba
they had
Yaga
done before.
I'm pretty
but again,
sure
it's been
did.
So many years now.
Yeah, precisely. No, I know.
And I think
Baba
they've
Yaga.
Also posited the like there are multiple of a lot of these things.
Exactly.
So whatever.
So I was fine with that. I really enjoyed the opening, and I thought one thing I you know it's a shame when Dean comes clean to Sam about you know about the fact that Jack's gonna you know probably die,
right,
et cetera, et cetera. And I didn't I've seen them do this kind of scene previously, but better.
Yeah.
Although, on one hand, I can sort of picture Sam just being sort of like, I'm so fucking dumb with this.
Right.
You know, I get that feeling.
I weirdly, and I think I feel like you did, like, it wasn't like the greatest Supernatural episode ever, but it was kind of weirdly, I don't know, I think if there hadn't been this big a break, it would have been interesting because it was the comfort of the, oh look, it's the unnecessary flashback episode.
Yeah.
Paired with the oh look, it's the random like we need to kill a little bit of time because our episode count is like one more than the plot needs.
Right. Yes.
Like I kind of just it's just two like comfort moments from the show at once in a weird way.
I get that. It would feel like if I wouldn't if this happened in like in the middle of like I don't know season 8, I'd be like, yeah, okay.
Right. The fact that it's like four episodes from the end is a little weird.
Yeah, exactly. Like, when it comes to this point, I'm like, well, right, I clearly had the script and so on. But, but that's all right. I'm not going to like, scream in rage that we got a Supernatural episode that wasn't the best Supernatural episode ever.
Right, and in a weird way, it was kind of classic Supernatural in not being a great Supernatural episode.
Precisely. Like, I thought that the one before it had, like, it was classic Supernatural with some really... some really sort of great sort of like moments
you know,
with Dean and Amara and so on. And this is like another kind of classic Supernatural episode.
Exactly. Like I am curious because we both rewatch shows eventually.
Exactly.
And in like a year or two, because it's going to be a while before I decide to, you know, at least me, decide to rewatch Supernatural. I am curious how that's going to go because there is a lot of Supernatural I'm not really fond of. Like,
oh, sure.
Like, that thing is, like, from about, like, high middling to awesome, the show is, you understand exactly where the show's lasted 15 years.
Yeah.
But from, like, low middling straight down, there's a lot of that. There's a couple seasons worth.
I know. There's, it had some, there are some longers in the mid-game.
Although, I do appreciate, that if you like, they've done things with like the like, oh, what episode do you regret the most? And it's that episode in season one with the bugs, where they're like,
oh,
this was just like
one.
The worst episode we ever did.
I thought you were gonna say it was the racist truck one, but okay.
No, weirdly. but I love that they've always pinned like that episode as like their worst episode, and it still is. Like they've never topped that specific episode for just a crap episode of TV.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
I mean, there's something to be appreciated that you did that in your first season. You never got quite that low again. it's a testament to something.
Point. Yeah,
but,
I remember that episode. You know, I remember it being not all that awful, but I maybe if I went back and watched it again, I would change my mind. But I will tell you this. After I watched those two episodes of Supernatural, and after sort of my appetite was wet for this kind of stuff with seeing the Dean and Amara scene, I went back and I watched my favorite episode. I watched the episode with my favorite Dean encounters Cosmic Force. Bit, and it isn't Dean being like, fuck you, I hate being on this hamster wheel. It's one where Dean is actually completely cowed, and it's the penultimate episode in season 5. When he meets death.
Yes, that is
which,
amazingly well done.
Which to me, like that was that whole that episode is pretty much Supernatural at its just like absolute best when the stakes, when you've got like a low budget network television show, and you actually manage to communicate cosmic stakes. And getting Julian Richings to play Death is, who else? I mean, he looks like a living skeleton. I mean, it's great.
No, and
Got a great
I do
face for
think
it.
that like that episode, I mean, everyone, you know, the entire Dean and Death relationship, which is still a thing today in the show,
I know,
is just
yes.
born out of how damn good that episode was.
Yes, exactly.
So, yeah. No,
Yeah, and he
great
sits
fucking hour of
down.
TV.
Yeah, and when he, yeah, the whole thing where he sort of, Dean's trying to face him down, and but Death is saying just, hand, like, cuts it, like gives him a slice of like deep dish pizza, and it's like eat, and Dean eats it, but he's terrified because he thinks maybe this will kill him. Maybe this is how death, because you understand like the massive amount of power, and the imbalance of power in that scene. So good. Anywho.
I do think it is interesting that the worst seasons of Supernatural are the ones that Sarah Gamble was the showrunner. And I find it interesting, given, of course, that Magicians, which she went on to co-create and run, is one of our favorite things. And I
I
wonder,
know.
I've always kind of wondered, right? Like, is it, and here's my personal bet, is that by then, Supernatural was Supernatural, right? We were 5 seasons in. The show was very firmly itself, it was a hit. She had to do Supernatural, and it's not really what she likes to do. Like, if she had been given her complete rein, and like, you can go anywhere with the show, it doesn't matter, blow it out of the water, and you know, we would have gotten like a much queerer, stranger, more broken version of Supernatural, I could see that being more in her wheelhouse. But it also makes sense to me that she did the Men of Letters thing, because I think she has a big fondness for here is our home base, and it's kind of awesome and fun to poke around at. You know,
Yeah,
like the
that
physical
makes
kids
sense.
college, right? Like here's our place. She seems very big
Yeah,
into place.
exactly. Yeah, well, you kind of need that sort of feeling. Sarah. Was Sarah Gamble also involved in some ways in the Vampire Diaries? I'm just trying to
I don't think so.
see. Maybe I'm imagining that.
Maybe?
Oops. Maybe not. I don't know. Could be completely wrong. But anyway, that's neither here nor
Yeah, I know
there.
she did Magicians U. I know she ran like a few seasons of Supernatural until she basically left. Yeah, no, I'm not saying.
Oh, she was also a producer on You. I forgot
Well, yeah,
about
no, that's
that.
her other show.
Yeah.
She is the co-creator of that as well, which I
No.
still want to
Oh,
watch.
I guess she kind of got her she kind of got herself started with Supernatural. Okay.
Yeah.
Never mind. Never mind then.
So yeah,
But
no,
I do
You is one
love
of those
that.
things I kind of really want to watch.
Oh, well, I enjoyed the first season. The second season sort of spun out into absurdity.
Gotcha. Yeah, I've never seen any of it.
What was I going to say? Well, I do like in I do like the way that Supernatural gave rise to all these showrunners who went on, like Jeremy Carver, Sarah Gamble, Eric Kripke and the boys. So we've got all these sort of, I always feel these are always spin-offs in some way of the original.
Well,
I don't know.
it's what well, no, it's that thing. It's the Walker Texas Ranger effect. No, I mean that in the best way. Like,
No,
if you look
I
at
get
people
it.
who worked on Walker, you get like Sean Ryan. You get like so many writers who got their start on Walker because it had been around forever. And I think Supernatural is the only thing that's been around forever now. So it's that so many writers move in and out of that show and learn from people who've been doing this for so long that it is a great classroom.
Yes. Yeah,
So there
yeah.
you go with
Yeah,
that.
Carver. Yeah, Carver did. I know he did Doom Patrol, but he also apparently was a producer on Frequency, which I don't know if
Okay.
you ever saw that, but it was a
I did
one.
not,
It
but I
was a
know of it.
one season series based on the movie. And actually, I really enjoyed Frequency. And I was disappointed when it got canceled after one season.
I did hear that Mindhunter has been canceled. We'll not get a season 3.
Yeah, Fincher has basically said, yeah, not in the near future at all.
I'm done hunting mines.
That's right.
And like a couple years later, they'll find him like in an alley smoking a cigarette, be like, I ain't hunted mines in a year. Let's get back to mind hunting.
That'd be good. Hey, I found me a mind. Put that down. Yeah. Yep. Well, you know what? But Finn, I'm very much looking forward to Mank. That's just when I thought I was out.
So I thought I was done hunting mines. I don't know why that sentence is so funny to me. Oh, fuck. Anyway, really, that Supernatural is pretty much the only new thing I watched because I got heavily into Discovery.
Yeah, which is funny because I'm getting into Discovery at the same time as you.
Right, and Christopher Cantwell.
Yeah.
I think I mentioned that it was really funny that I was like, at a certain episode, I'm like, I don't know how I feel about this plot point. And on Twitter, like, there's Cantwell going, I don't know how I feel about this plot point in Discovery. I'm watching it for the first time. I'm like, same episode. I get you. I feel you. You know?
Yes.
So, hey. But it's meaningless, but it makes me laugh. I am further than you because I have not been watching anything else, really. I have started the second season. And, of course, we both started watching because there's a cat in the third season, and that's all we care about.
Pretty much. I'm waiting for Grudge the Cat to show up.
Yeah. But, no, Discovery, like, it looped me in really quick. Like, the first two-parter, like, the first two episodes, I was just like, no, this is kind of that darker reality of DS9 and kind of the brain and heart of it with the spirit of the original show.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of, and I then think it that's keeps what they're going. Yeah.
And you're brushing up against, like, I can't say anything. Because I was going to say, like, there's a big plot point that they teased in three different ways that I was like, holy shit, you guys are genius. And I caught, like, two of them and I didn't catch the third. But, like, the back half of the season is a whole new thing. Like, the show finds its feet hard.
Huh. Because I've been enjoying it. I mean, I've just started. I believe I'm just started episode 9. I think that's where I am. Yeah, or perhaps episode 10.
Let me see.
They found. I just watched the episode where Saru goes crazy on the musical planet. Unfortunately, they don't do musicals. It just produces a resonance.
Right.
I think the title is the Latin of "If you want peace, prepare for war."
Right, and the end of that episode, which they basically were like, "What the shit?" You
know, it's like we want harmony, and the Pavel or whatever the creatures are called are like, "Okay, we're gonna call the Klingons." What? Oh shit! So this is it was like,
and they jump.
Yes.
Oh no!
Well, I mean,
right?
They
yeah, because. You get to the jump at the end, right? Because 9 yeah. has that weird jump that ends with a what?
Ooh.
And then, yeah, no, you get into the back half of the episode and it's a whole different show.
Oh, nice. Okay.
And they start really going hard and deep into character.
Oh, no, because I've been enjoying it. I've been enjoying the show, that's for sure. I'm just, just kind of...
It's kind of like the first half of the season is set up for the show. It's to ground you in the world again, right?
What I find the plot point that I'm or the hint that I find really fascinating, and they set it up with a tardigrade and the spore drive. When what's his face becomes infuses himself with tardigrade DNA and begins to be like becomes a spore drive essentially the.
Yeah.
Then he comes out of the jumps and he's referring to people by the wrong titles.
Uh-huh.
It's like, oh shit, they're going to mirror universe us here.
Did you catch the first time when he's in his bathroom and says, you know, like, no, I'm fine, and walks away, and in the mirror, he's still there?
Oh shit, really? I missed that. I must not have been looking at the screen or something. Crap. Okay.
Yeah, no, it that was the first, like, well, and weirdly enough, that was the second thing that threw me. The first one has just been people talking about how Lorca seems changed.
Oh, yeah.
And how he seems to be, you know, like acting weird. And he does seem a little weird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. There's one more clue that I didn't get until after the rug pull, and I was like, "Oh, you bastards!"
Okay, I will wait and discover it for myself. For the pure
fun
of it.
But also, I'm sure you know, right? Like, this is just kind of common knowledge, is that they eventually do bring in Pike and eventually Spock and all that, right?
Right. Yeah, I know. In season two, they bring in Pike. Yeah. Yeah.
So early in season two. Mm. And what's amazing to me is the way they do Pike is a really interesting thing. Because they do Pike like he's Kirk, but more settled.
Hmm.
And what it manages to say, because again, like, you know, the Constellation class, like the Enterprise stuff, is that 5-year mission ship, right?
Mm-hmm.
The captains for these 5-year mission ships, at least at that era, were like, no, we want these people who are just kind of like, they kind of have a sense of humor. They kind of can disregard laws because they have to be completely self-reliant. They are a different type of captain.
Huh.
And that's a really nice touch because it separates everything else from the original show and Next Generation.
Cool. Oh, I like this.
Yeah, no, and like I said, so far season two, what's interesting also is that it changes showrunners every season so far.
Yes, I knew that.
And it seems to actually help the show, not hurt it. Because so far, season two has been even better.
Oh, sweet. One thing I really like about season two, or even though I haven't seen it, I really like their choice for Pike actor Anson Mount.
Yeah.
Like, he looks like, because the thing about Anson Mount is he looks like a 60s television star who maybe had a career in the movies and now he's doing like genre TV. Like,
exactly.
That's the look. That's the look you need for Christopher Pike.
He isn't a mirror image, obviously, of Pike, like the original actor. He doesn't,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's reminiscent, but, you know, they're not casting for exact, like, facial anything. But he feels exactly the same. He feels like what Pike should feel like. He inhabits the energy.
Exactly. And I feel this is a better role for him than Black Bolt or whatever he played on Marvels and Humans.
Oh, Jesus, that's right. He does that, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. And which he was not able to actually have any lines.
Just, like, leave that off your reel, dude.
No. Just, oh my god. Someday I will have to go back and actually watch all of the episodes of Marvels and Humans.
Why?
Because I couldn't do it. I could not do it.
No, but why would you?
I'm just so curious. Like, it just felt like early 80s bad television. It was like I'd never seen anything like so strangely inept from, like, you know, the late teens in the 21st century. I was just sort of like, where are you getting your cinematographers and your writers and everything? Like, did you build a time machine and, like, you know, find the people who did Battlestar Galactica 80 and, like, get them to do this? Because that's what it looks like and sounds like.
Anyway. So one of the things, and I know that, like, everyone's going to be sick of me saying it, but one of the things I did feel about Discovery, and it's heightened in season two, because season two so far is at least funnier. And I think part of that is the Pike stuff, but also just other characters are allowed to be a little bit funnier.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see more of this again as you, not even the funny, but just when you get to the back half of the season. But this really is the, dear God, Farscape changed science fiction forever, didn't it, on TV? Because this is the Farscape version of Star Trek in a lot of ways.
Oh, that's an interesting take.
Darker, and you'll see it more again in the back half of the season, but it's just that darker kind of, like, all we have is us. You know, and everyone's kind of broken in different ways, and you just have to move together.
Mm-hmm.
There are also a couple moments in the first season, I don't think you've hit one yet, and there's a few more, like, I've already hit, that are gorgeous with one of these. This is what it means to be in the Federation. Damn you.
Right.
You know, like, we stand up for hope. Like, we don't leave people behind. And it's just, they are those great, like, fist pump, like, yeah, this is the fucking Federation moments that I don't know. I feel like Star Trek needs, and it doesn't get very often.
Huh.
Just kind of reminding you, like, that's what makes Star Trek different.
Hmm. Okay. Well, I'll wait for that.
So, yeah.
Also a moment I enjoyed. It was in episode 7, Magic to Make the Sanest Man Go Mad, with featuring Rainn Wilson as Harry Mudd. When they do a time loop episode. I love being a good time loop.
And Rainn Wilson does such a great Mudd.
I know. It's amazing. He's like, it's just the right amount of ham bone.
Yeah.
You can tell he's like, holy shit, I get to play Harry Mudd. This is like just delightful. I enjoyed him killing everybody, specifically Lorca, repeatedly.
Yes.
Like finding, and at one point he goes, there are so many ways to blow up this ship. It's almost a design flaw. Which made me chuckle. But at the very end, when they basically get the better of him and they call down his tragic lost love, Stella.
Uh-huh.
And
did
she shows
you do the
up
same, like, yeah.
Yeah, I was like, oh, that's, is that, is, that's Officer Hot.
Yeah, I was like, holy shit.
But it took me a minute to like put it together, because I'm like, I know that face.
It was that just weirdly creepy smile.
Yes.
That she does on One on Earth when she's possessed, which is even funnier in this context. But it was just, it's such a uniquely creepy smile that I was just like, oh shit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was, I got a genuine kick out of that one.
Yeah.
And of course the joke being that, you know, Harry Mudd's worst fate, very worst fate that he can imagine, is to live a settled down life with one person.
Which doesn't last for long, as we find out.
Oh, good. Okay.
Well, no, in the original series.
In the original series, yes, I know. But are we, okay. But yeah, that was kind of a pleasure to have Harry Mudd involved. Yeah. I don't know if we're gonna get any more Mudd. I hope so. He's just I can't imagine they would keep him at bay for too long, because it's just too much.
I mean,
fun.
Well, the problem is, again, like, you still have to plug into the original series stuff, so it gets hard.
Yeah, and now of course we are in season 3. We have jumped into the future, so we are
right, and probably permanently, because that solves so many problems.
Oh yes, exactly. So, well, they're not beholden to, like, anything anymore. They can chart their own course.
Someone points out that it's the first time we've gone past where we were in Star Trek since, like, Nemesis.
Yikes.
Because, well, the Kelvin movies don't go past it.
That's true.
So it's that last Next Gen episode that is the furthest in the future we've ever been. And I mean, I guess Picard, but this is further than that.
Right.
So we're finally moving forward again in time in Star Trek. Which is interesting, because it's about, you know, and I think there were a lot of people who were, well, where does this plug in? How does this match? How does, you know, they're using holograms, and in the original show they're using screens. They actually address that, by the way.
Oh, okay.
With a very quick, offhanded, hysterical moment.
Cool.
And I don't think it's giving anything away. It's just, you know, when we have Pike, he calls someone and the guy on the other end is just like, it's only you and my grandmother that uses screens. Like, what is up with that? And Pike's just like, you know, I like them. I think they're more reliable.
Nice.
And you're just like, okay, fine.
Fine. You know, I mean, I don't care too much about Star Trek continuity. Like,
right.
If, you know, I know some people do. Really care. Me, I'm just more concerned with enjoying the show for what it is in the moment. But I do appreciate that you have to sort of have some fidelity. You can't just play completely fast and loose.
Right.
And
like, they,
jumping into the future is the way to around all this.
Yeah. I mean, it also lets them deal with stuff in a new way, right? Like, you can bring in new technology that you couldn't do in the original show that actually feels more like the future again, not like something we've already seen.
Exactly.
Which, because, you know, I mean, Star Trek was, you know, the future, right? And then Next Gen, it was, look, we have these touchscreen things way before, you know, we had, like, iPads and all that and tablets.
Right.
And it used to always be, like, this is what the future could look like. And that stopped when they stopped moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
And Discovery obviously can't really do it. Because we have to undo it. because we didn't have it in the original stuff. Mm-hmm. So this, moving forward, lets them hopefully kind of go, and now it's a future again.
Right. And there's one little, I think it was in Discovery, this delightful touch when they're talking about getting different programs for the replicators. It's like, yeah. I can do this on this replicator. And I'm like, oh, this kind of makes sense. Like, because the replicator promises like complete abundance of anything, but you see, but there's still, it's still not exactly evenly distributed. Right.
Right.
Which I thought, okay, this is probably how things would shake out. So
yeah.
I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, no, it's a weirdly smart show. Also, can we just say, like, I'm not in love with the shape of the ship, right? Like, the Enterprise, just the original Enterprise, like, all the, they still just look pretty in a very undefinable way.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow the weird triangle shape in Discovery just doesn't quite do it for me.
Fair enough.
It's close, but the spore drive jump effect is so pretty.
Yeah, that is really nice. Yeah.
I so appreciated that. Also, the Forerunner android thing in Discovery makes me happy. You know, it's like, we're not at data levels yet. We have
exactly.
Some AI, but it's kind of rough around the edges.
Right, we're getting there. We're getting, you know, we'll get to data level at some point.
Yeah.
Then we'll get lore.
Jesus, and can we not get lore?
And at some point, I actually really should watch that last episode of Picard season one.
Yeah, I have to watch the last two eventually. I might actually just skip them and just start the second season and give it a restart.
Yeah, I mean, you might be better off.
Because they'll do a, like, previously on, and I'll be like, sure, previously on when you were just explaining the plot badly. Don't do that again, or I'm out, you know. there are also supposed to be two Discovery spinoff shows starting up eventually.
Oh, really?
Yeah, one I will not mention. Do not look for it. It will blow something for you.
Okay.
But once you get to the end of, like, once you get to, like, season two, you'll be like, oh, I need that show. And again, eventually there's supposed to be a Pike show as well.
Oh, yes, I knew that.
Which, that's going to be weird. Because again, there's a very small window you can do that show in. But we do know that Pike had a full 5-year mission.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, but it is that hard thing of, like, you can't pull out certain stops because you know what happens.
Right. Oh, hey, if the Pike show, this is where my idea for a Star Trek, like, late night interview and variety show can come to pass.
I like it.
Yeah. Now, with you, like, imagine Christopher Pike coming out and doing, like, there's a little routine, then he introduces a guest, you know, they, et cetera.
Yeah. So also, the Queen's Gambit. As we start running down the clock a little bit.
Yes, Queen's Gambit.
I didn't get to see it yet, so tell me. Tell me all about it.
I only saw the first 7 episodes, which is, coincidentally, the entire series.
Okay.
So I watched the whole damn thing. Yeah, and as listeners, as dedicated listeners to our show will know, I am a huge fan of Walter Tevis's novel, The Queen's Gambit.
Yes.
You as well enjoyed it, although I know not quite as much as I did.
Not quite as much as you, but yes.
So when they announced that they were making a series based on this, I was over the moon. And I found out that the showrunner, writer, and director is Scott Frank, who actually has done one of my favorite movie scripts of all time, which is Out of Sight.
Yes.
Because I remember I loved the movie when it came out, but I also would get the script from the library, the university library, and I read that several times because it is just, like, if you want to know how to make a script that's a little bit fractured, a little bit, you know, off from the usual, but still is, like, incredibly good at, like, delineating character in, like, an instant, Scott
right.
Frank's Out of Sight script is perfect. At any rate, so yeah, so Queen's Gambit is the story of Elizabeth Harmon, a young orphan girl who ends up is also happens to be a chess genius, and she goes from learning to play chess And then she's adopted by, you know, at age 13 or so, she says. It's probably more like 15.
Right.
And sort of begins to rise in the ranks of the chess world. And at the end, ends up in Moscow playing against Viktor Borgov, sort of the world champion grandmaster. And it's funny because she barely loses throughout the whole thing. I think right. There's only two matches in the whole seven episodes that she loses. And these are crushing losses that send her into this spiral of addiction. Because that's the other part of Harmon's character. She's also a drug addict, and she's a drug addict from like the age of like 9, because the orphanage that they put her in literally gives them tranquilizers. Like,
yikes, yeah.
And it's just funny, they all line up in the morning to get their vitamins, like their vitamins and their tranquilizers for their disposition, as they say. And at some point, of course, they say, okay, we can't give you the tranquilizers anymore. It's illegal, as it turns out.
Whoops.
But she has to sort of cope with this addiction, and it's made very clear that her like obsessive genius and her addiction are pretty much one and the same thing.
Sure.
Like they are two sides to this character. But as much as I enjoy the fact that it was adapted, I was also a little surprised because, and you've read the book, so I'm sure you'll agree. Harmon's character doesn't really have like a regular arc.
Yeah.
Like the 9-year-old girl in the orphanage is the exact same person who,
right.
who wins, you know, as a young woman, like in her 20s, wins, you know, the world championships. Like there is no change. She's still exactly who she is. And that's in the book. That's kind of the point, because at the very end of the book, I'm spoiling everything for anyone who listens. She wins against Borgov, essentially gets up, leaves the hall, and then goes out into the park where there are old, you know, Russian men playing chess, and sits down and starts to play. And the moment isn't really triumphant, like not the way that I read it. It was sort of like there was nothing, suddenly there was nothing more for her but to do more of the same thing. And it was... there was something kind of, I don't know, there was something kind of tragic in her great victory.
Right.
But the, so the show does the same thing with her victory, but it's played for like complete triumph.
Ooh.
And it's a real, it is not the way this show should have ended. But I kind of think, you know, maybe it would have been like an unacceptable ending to do it the way Tevis does it in the book. But at the same time, it's like I was with the series right up until that moment, and then I'm like, yeah, kind of whiffed it.
Yeah, I mean, most Tevis adaptations like know that's what he does, right? Like it's it's not so much. I mean, there are always character arcs, but also kind of the immutable sense of self, right? Like it's not right. it's that, you know, you're tilting, it's kind of tilting against windmills and you always lose because all mm-hmm. you do is stare in the same place.
Yeah, exactly. And
you look at the hustler, you look at Color of Money, for instance. Like that's what they do.
Right. Yeah. Or and you look at Man Who Fell to Earth,
right.
The main character just ends up like basically this defeated alcoholic alien, you know, sitting there just kind of like defeated by his experience. And that's right. The thing in The Queen's Gambit, she's kind of defeated by her own victories, but Frank, for whatever reason, decides to like give her this great sort of like triumphant ending
in ways that
just seem like it just veers so much into sentimentality at that point. It's like, no.
That's the thing. It's like once you start tossing around sentimentality with Tevis's work, you're wrong.
Exactly. Yes.
Like he was never sentimental. That's the thing.
Yeah. And
like,
I have
a point of almost horror. You know.
That's right. Yeah. It's kind of it's Tevis's work is I think pitiless in a way.
Right.
It's full of compassion for his characters, but there's absolutely no pity spared for them.
Yeah.
And this, even though I think they get the ending completely wrong in Queen's Gambit, at the same time, I loved most of it.
Sure.
Anya Taylor-Joy was like an extremely good choice for this role.
Nice.
Also, the child who plays young Elizabeth, mm-hmm. is, I think, even better. Like, she does this sort of like obsessive sort of almost blankness that the character needs really well. And you know, there are some other issues I have with it, but I wouldn't steer people away from it. But I would say, you know, maybe read the novel and you know, compare for yourself.
That's fair.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. You know, it's one of those, I still want to see it eventually. I don't know when I will.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly,
I certainly recommend the first episode. The character of Mr. Seibel, or sort of the janitor who teaches her to play chess, mm-hmm. is played by Bill Camp, and he is like incredibly nice. Good. Yeah, like he has that character down. Like, it's the exact right way to play it. So
perfect.
Which I quite liked.
All right. Well, unless we have anything else, we're kind of hitting the hour mark. So.
No, I think we got it. We nailed it.
And I do think that we managed to say that there wouldn't be an episode. I mean, not that we put these up in a timely fashion anyway, just because of life. But we thought we were going to skip this week, and we're actually skipping next week because I spent all this past week confused as to what day it was, to the point of I moved a whole week. Because you know, we always take the time change week off. And I thought that was this weekend, and it's next weekend. So
yeah.
Anyway,
there we go. Next weekend,
we'll play some new music.
Whoop, whoop. Woo.